host of other indie luminaries.
Really?
Yes.
Is that what it said?
That's what it says. I made them read it to me.
I would assume that they may not have been contacted.
Yeah, exactly. They're just running late. That's all. They're just understanding.
Held at the bar.
I know. Believe me, all the great convention panels are held at the bar. You guys have no idea. Any questions? Again, Jeff, needs no introduction. Bone, Rassel.
Well, Mark Wade is. We don't need to do that. I'll tell you what. I'll tell a story while we're trying to warm up. When I was starting out doing self-publishing in the early 90s, I kind of ran into this Dave Sim guy who was doing Cerebus. He was self-published. And a group of us kind of got together and started doing shows together. Colin Dorn, Martin Wagner, and James Owen. And the five of us would go to shows. And we would go to the Diamond retailer event. And the five of us would get together and do a signing. This huge line would show up, and we would block all of DC and Marvel's booths. And they would get mad, and we were actually banned from the showroom floor.
Oh, man.
And so I don't remember who came up with it. It was probably Dave. But he decided, well, we'll go. We'll tell everybody that, we're going to be at the hotel bar.
Oh.
If you come out to the bar and buy us a beer, we'll draw you a picture or anything. Empty the place out.
Yeah.
We had everybody in the bar, and Dave and I were sitting in the booth, and people would just come over and just like on those. I think there was even wine, and just come over and boy, we got drunk. Oh,
yeah.
I had a lot of Heinekens. I will tell you,
beer stinks.
Yeah. Dave Sim.
We had a fun one.
Dave Sim is a mad, mad genius. The very first time I ever met Dave. Was I was working as a convention volunteer. Your ticket to Superstardom, ladies and gentlemen, in Dallas in 1982 or 83. And it's important to remember what the date was because he had just broken up with Denis.
Yeah.
And he was just.
I heard a rumor that she got on the back of Scott Lobdell's bike or something like that.
Something like that. It's
a legend.
It's a legend. It's somebody else's. I'll tell you later. But,
oh, okay.
but it was it was weird. I never met the guy before, but he gets off the plane. I'm picking up at the airport. He's devastated, and he just because he has nobody else to talk to at this point, he just starts pouring his soul out to me. And I'm like a 22 year old kid who picked him up at the airport. I'm like who loves Cerebus, but still. And I remember we did the little morbid thing where he was absolutely convinced that Lee Harvey Oswald did not act alone, and therefore he made us drive through Dealey Plaza and then take the route to the hospital and stuff, make the weird morbid drive all the way and reenact the crime.
All the way to the hospital.
Yeah, that was a little weird. And then we ended up back at the hotel bar, and one thing led to another. It was one beer led to another. One beer led to 12, and it was just. And I wasn't really drinking much, but boy, my God, he put him back. And I wish to God I'd kept a tape recording or a notebook of the stuff I heard that night, because there were stories that would just turn your hair white about.
Me on the other hand, I can't get it out on.
I know, yeah. So. But, again, one of the more talented guys one of the greatest visionaries who ever worked in comics. And what a lunatic.
Yeah, he was very visionary. He definitely kind of was, thinking that where we would be where we are.
Yeah, he's one of the first guys to say, you know what, I want big, fat, phone book-sized trade paperbacks of my work. He was the first guy to do the phone book.
He was the first guy that I'm aware of that said, my comic is ongoing, it's still popular. I'm going to start collecting them in these permanent collections.
Yes.
I don't know anybody else doing that. And then when I came in 92, I started doing that with Bone. And I think I was like...
Yeah, there still weren't many people doing it.
I don't think anybody was doing it, because even Sandman at that time was... They just cherry-picked one popular thing.
Right, so one story arc or something. Exactly. Yeah, but they weren't like packaging complete runs of this stuff. And they certainly hadn't followed the paradigm that we have now where... Pretty much everything after 6 or 7 months or so, or whatever, 4 or 5 issues, is collected as a trade, because that's, frankly, sometimes it's the only way you can make a profit off of it, is by doing just by being paid for the same work twice. You in the front row, sir. You had a question, if you still do.
Yeah, actually, I just heard
like a young Jack Kirby, actually. I'm sorry, why not?
I heard that Bowen was challenged at a library.
Oh yeah, this weekend. Yeah, it's it just happened like on Friday, or I just found out about it on Friday. A teacher in, or no, like a parent in Minnesota somewhere saw her son was reading Bone and was shocked. She filed a complaint. She wants Bone banned from the school, wants it to be taken away, and doesn't want any kids to get near. She said it was filled with alcohol and gambling and smoking and sex.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow.
Wow.
I,
are we sure she wasn't reading that?
Yeah. I said, you have to write one of my books. I do have a book that has that in it. It's, yes.
Jeff, just to let you know that every single kid that I've met, I've introduced them to Bone, they're hooked.
Fantastic.
Especially the ones who
gambling.
Love
gambling.
Especially the ones who love the gambling smoke. black T-shirt.
It's the first I've ever heard of it. Yeah.
Yeah.
The challenges?
Yeah.
Well, actually, I read a couple of articles. I mean, I didn't talk to anybody at the school. I read about it, same as anybody else, and on the internet. And what somebody actually called the Library Association to get their reaction. They defended me, and they thought that they were overreacting. But that person, the librarian who was representing the ALA, said, this is only like the fourth time anyone's ever challenged Bone, which I'd never heard of the first three. This one blew up a little bit more. But you know, I mean, I don't even know what to say about that. There is, you know, gambling and smoking and drinking in Bone, but it's really not part of the story, and it's usually the unsavory characters like Phony Bone or Smiley Bone. And it's usually him trying to use those things to, like, set up a scam.
Right, none of those aspects are glorified.
No. They always lead to trouble. I mean, he always gets in trouble. So there's just no way anyone's ever been rewarded for those behaviors or in any way could be interpreted as encouraging. As far as, like, sex in Bone, I don't know what she was looking at, but her sex tolerance level must be really low. She claimed, she said that she read Volume 4, which is the Dragon Slayer one, which I don't remember exactly where the story breaks and what's in there, but I think I can't remember exactly. I think they had a contest of who could sell the most beer at which end of the bar in order to control the town. And it gets completely out of control, and there's mob mentality, and the alcohol is actually shown as a bad agent. So all I can assume from this is that just not everybody's smart enough to read comic books.
Yeah. I also think, I'm just going to go off on a political soapbox here for a second, my knee-jerk liberal bent that I have, which has nothing to do with indie comics, but it's not like, you know, it's not like there's anybody else up here talking. I think there's a couple of things that are play into here. I think that the internet and the existence of the internet makes that sort of thing more common than it used to be. We went through a period where, as a society, we became, you know, more liberal and more forgiving of that sort of thing. And it's not the 1950s, and we're no longer seeing commies around every corner. We're no longer, you know, book burning as much. I think that what we're seeing now is that what the internet, and again, I'm not slagging on the internet. It is what it is. It's a force for good or evil, depending upon who's using it. But I think that one of the things that the internet provides is that, you know, when you and I were growing up, and when most of us were growing up in the audience, you know, if you lived down in East Jesus Nowhere and you had a crackpot theory about something, or if you were incensed about, you know, in this case, I think that, you know, the gambling, drugs, and sex in this one book or whatever, you know, you'd talk to other people and they would, like, set you straight because it's a crackpot theory, and you would eventually have to listen to, because as being part of society, you're sort of forced to listen to other people's points of view and maybe come up with a more rational synthesis of all this stuff. With the advent of the internet, there's no opinion wacky or crazy enough that exists that you can't find 12 other people out there who will share that with you, and somebody out there will listen to you and be part of it. You can be part of a community out there of nut jobs and wing nuts.
Yeah, and honestly, I don't actually expect this book to get banned in this school. There's going to be a review process, and in the article I read, I guess, you know, over the last 10 years or so, there's been like 20 books that have been challenged. 18 of them were given the bill, free bill of health. They only took two off the shelves. And I can't really imagine that they're going to actually open up Bone. They're certainly not. I'd be so surprised if they found anything that encouraged kids to gamble or do anything bad or have sex. I mean, there's just nothing like that in there. So if, you know, she just has a high tolerance for protecting her son. And if she doesn't want her son to see a little cartoon Bone smoking a stogie, fine. She can keep it
that's
away
right.
from
that's
him.
Your, that's right as a parent.
I have a really low tolerance myself for what I would consider a very un-American practice of banning books.
Right.
I mean, let's leave that to the Nazis and not us.
Well,
America's going to do that.
Well, especially, isn't this woman a librarian according to the reports?
Yeah.
Or no?
Well, no, she has some kind of.
Okay, I don't want to be spreading false information, so that's not true. That's not true. So, you had a question, sir, actually. Yes, sir?
Time management. Well, you better take this.
God, nothing. Unplug your internet router for several hours a day.
That's probably the best advice you're ever going to get.
That's where it all goes. That's the black hole. If you look at every writer's internet history for a day, you know, you will find, and we all go on with the best of intentions. We're all like, oh, what's a synonym for Rampart? And then, you know, half an hour later, you're looking at old YouTube episodes of What's My Line? The trail that leads you there is true. Oh, yeah, porn, PDQ. So that'll kill you. I did a hell of a lot more work before the internet found me and stole my soul. That's a big part of it. Also, just, you know, I actually do have some advice. I tell this to a lot of writing students. I do a lot of teaching and writing classes and stuff. And this is pretty much antithetical to anything anybody else will ever tell you, which is the prevalent myth is, you know, the answer to writing and be creating and drawing and stuff is sit down in a chair and write. And just sit down, you put your ass in a chair and write. Just don't get up and stuff. And that sounds great. But you know what? There's some days it's happening, there's some days it's not. And I have seen more people, and if that works for you, if you are productive doing that, then by all means, grab onto that and don't let it go. But more importantly, if that's not working for you, if that's creating stress in you that overrides the creative process, I mean, if you need instead to go get on your bicycle and ride around for a while, or you got to go out in the woods, or you got to just, you know, whatever you got to do to feed your head, latch onto that. And if you find anything that works, I think you're backing up on this, if you find anything that works, that makes you feel creative, for the love of God, hold on to that and don't let go, because it's fairly rare. I have seen more students waste years being frustrated and sort of beating themselves up about the fact that they're not following the process. Like, they're not in the chair 8 hours a day, and they feel bad about that. You know, that's wasted energy. Instead put that energy back into finding it. I would love to sit here and tell you that I sit down in the chair at 5 o'clock every, you know, 8 o'clock in the morning, you know, like Ralph and Sam, the dog, just, you know, punching out, punching in. It doesn't work. That's not right for me. It's right for other people. Chuck Dixon is a machine. Chuck Dixon is a great writer. Chuck Dixon is a guy who just literally, like, or Jeff Johns. Jeff Johns gets up in the morning, literally, 9 o'clock in the morning, ding, and he just writes. If that works for you, that's swell. But, dude, I don't
know.
That
doesn't work for me.
Yeah.
In fact, I was getting ready to start the next issue of Rassle, was recently, and I was watching The Maltese Falcon. Because I kind of wanted to have that noirish thing. I want to have all those kind of stinger, tough guy moments. And my wife comes back from work, and I'm sitting there watching a movie.
Yeah.
I'm working, hon.
Yeah.
That's not as bad. That's not as bad, however, as when she catches me on the couch with my eyes closed, and she's like, "What are you doing?" I'm like, "I'm writing."
Yeah. Right. But that's
you
true.
Can write with your eyes closed. Right?
Writing is not typing, man. And if you're like me, if you have that. The frustrating thing about those flashpoint moments when you suddenly, in the middle of nowhere, just crack a storytelling problem or see something you didn't see before. Let me ask you this.
Okay, so writer's block. Okay. Everybody has it. Everybody worries about it. Okay, I've got a theory, and I don't worry about writer's block as much anymore.
Yeah.
I'll get to something, and I'm just not getting anything done. I'm working, and it just doesn't seem like anything's really getting done. And maybe, you know, the only thing that I'm worried about is that, you know, my deadline's starting to get a little closer.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, something will happen, and it'll crack the nut. You'll go, and it'll be something you had forgotten to put in.
Yeah.
And I think that's what writer's block is.
Yeah.
You're just chill out and wait. There's something you need to put in there that's coming. You don't, it just, you don't know what it is. It's going to bubble up from, you know, the basement of your brain.
And what sucks about that is that it's not necessarily going to come if you sit there for 5 hours at the computer. It may, but I have had many, many, many really great sort of, oh my God, I can lay down for the rest of the day ideas on a Sunday afternoon out of the blue after sitting at the computer for six hours on Saturday and accomplishing nothing. And I know, looking back, I could have sat at the computer for 12 hours and I would have accomplished nothing. And sometimes you just got to wait for that bolt to hit. I also, let me, as an ancillary, I'm sorry, you going to say something?
No.
I was going to say, as an ancillary, I agree with you about writer's block. I think even more concretely, my feeling about what writer's block is that, in my experience, you've got to be flexible with your story as you tell it. I mean, I think it's great if you've got your ending figured out and if you've got your basic story beats and the mile markers that you want to hit, that you've got that stuff working. That's great to have that as a roadmap, but you can never be afraid of suddenly turning left in your story when you were supposed to turn right just to see where you go. And I think that what happens, I think that writer's block. I think that,
sorry, we're posing for pictures.
I think. I think that writer's block is your subconscious telling you that you have made a wrong turn in your story. And is holding you back and saying, whoa.
That's exactly what I was saying.
Yeah, it's exactly what you were saying.
Except I didn't say it as good.
No, but I
agree. That's what it is.
And so
you're trying to relax because there's something that something's going to trigger it.
Right.
And soon.
But you made a wrong turn. And you're subconscious saying, before you waste another 3 days going another 20 pages down this road, you idiot.
Go watch a movie,
clear your head, and at least for me, go back to the last place in the story where it really felt like it was working, and just as an experiment, turn right instead of turning left.
That is great advice.
Have a character make an unusual, unexpected decision, and just see where it takes you. The worst case scenario is it doesn't take you any further than you are now, but more often than not, it'll take you someplace interesting. The most common complaint I have, because we did a lot of anthologies at Boom, not so much anymore, but I mean, I still deal with mostly young, untried writers as the editor-in-chief, and my biggest complaint about most guys' stories is that I want to see someone in your story make a decision that I find interesting or surprising or unpredictable somewhere in your story. And if you're not doing that, and that the characters just sort of, then they feel like they're working off a script. They feel like, if I can kind of predict what they're doing, I don't know. Ancillary to all this, and I'll stop babbling in a second, but that's, my solution is go back to the place it worked. And then just try something new. Even if it doesn't lead anywhere, just try some wild, suddenly a meteor hits the ground, suddenly he's hit by a truck, I don't care, just try something. And I think that's what writer's block is, and I think that that's why, certainly in Los Angeles where I live, I think the reason that so many drawers and so many hard drives are filled with three-quarters of a screenplay from some guy who will never finish it, or two-thirds of their fantasy trilogy about dragons that they'll never finish is because we are trained in Western civilization to think that this kind of that putting together a story is like building a piece of IKEA furniture. You know, it's step one, step two, step three, you build and stuff. It's not like that at all. And I also know that it sucks to go back. It sucks to have to tear up the floorboards. I think that it sucks to get to the place where you realize, oh shit, I made a wrong choice, and to have the guts to tear up the floorboards and go back to where you were. Everybody in this room knows what it's like, to use IKEA as the continuing metaphor, what it's like to be on step 27 of building your armoire and realize that you left out an important step and, you know, a certain piece in step two. That sucks. There's nothing worse than having to tear back something down and build it back up. And the guys who have three quarters of a screenplay that they'll never finish are the guys who don't have the fortitude to say, all right, I got to go back to step two.
Your question, though, was also like, I think you were implying you have a regular job and you're still trying.
Yeah.
Well, one thing I found when I was first starting is it's hard, especially my other job was animation, so I was drawing all day. It was really tough to go draw for fun afterwards, but that you just got to muscle through that. Well, a really important thing is to find a place to work in your home. Out of your home is better, but it's kind of unrealistic when you're starting out. You've got to have a place where you can shut the door and leave it, because having your independent cartoon studio in the house, it's tough. You're always worried about it. You're always worried, like since I was self-published. Yeah. I was always worried about, you know, geez, did I fill that invoice? Did I, did I answer? Did I open all the mail? Did I pay my bills? And you got to, at some point, you got to shut the door, or else it's just really right there with you all the time. So just being able to isolate it will help a little bit. Yes, in the back.
How do you guys first get your books in front of you to get people to see it? You didn't have the internet then.
We didn't have Photoshop.
No.
I used to hand scratch letters on like a rub-on.
Yeah.
It was called Chart Pack.
This doesn't apply to me really, because I started in the majors. But as I don't mean that to sound in any way condescending, I'm just saying I started.
Oh, and the cat goes off.
But you know what I mean? I got lucky because I started with guys who were doing that job for me. What his is a much better story about this. So.
Well, I just started at ground level. Yeah. I mean, I did the comic. I went to the comic book store and they said, oh, well, we order them out of the catalogs, which there were 12 distributors back then. So it was kind of a different landscape. But the store said, you know, there's a Diamond Warehouse in our town. There used to be Diamond Warehouses all over the country. But there was one in Columbus, Ohio. So I went there, and they said, oh, yeah, you can put it. I showed it to the woman, and she looked at my... I had all 24 pages of the first issue of Bone done, and I photocopied it, and I went there. And her advice was, well, if you have someone in comics who could give you a blurb, that would help. And she explained to me how the catalogs worked and how to, you know, write to the Capital or Diamond or Friendly Franks or whatever, and get material to solicit in their catalogs, to how to do it. So I did it that way slowly, and I think the next big step was Diamond and Capital used to have giant shows, like in the so once a year, like in Baltimore or in New York or something, they would have a big show, and all the retailers would go to it. Well, I didn't know anybody in comics, so I would go with the guys who own the comic book stores. I would get in the cars with them, and we would all drive up there. So the first 2 years I was in comics, I was hanging out with the retailers. I was going to the bar with the retailers. I didn't know anybody. I was going out and having cigarettes with retailers outside, and I met Rory Root, who did Comics Relief, Jim Hanley, Jim Hanley's Universe. So I'm having drinks with all these guys, and these are the people who are your end customers, and they certainly were back then. These are the guys who buy your comic non-returnable, not the customers, not the collectors. It's those retailers. So I spent 2 years making a lot of friends with important people who could change my life. So that was really crucial. And then after that, then I started meeting Neil Gaiman and Frank Miller and Dave Sim, also all in the hotel bar. and it just kind of slowly progressed like that. I would go to these shows, to answer your question, short run, like somebody running around in the country music star, going to every little low-watt radio station and handing them my single. That's what I did. The first 8 issues of Bone, that's all I did. I went all around the country, just gave my books to people. And
realize the phrase is low watt radio station and handing them my single mean nothing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Chart pack.
I know. And yeah.
Chart pack. Remember that? I remember when recent cuts were a nickel.
Yes, sir. Five V's for a nickel.
You guys are kind of working on books right now that aren't really, that are sort of outside of what most people think of, whatever they think of your body of work. And so there's bound to be some sort of controversy about the kinds of books that you've written. The problem I have is that I think there's something wrong with my head, and all the stories I come up with, I think, well, no one would ever want to read it.
Well, and you'll have to do a bit of it and show it to somebody.
Out, and the ones that I think, oh, well, that might be something somebody wants to read, never go.
We'll never write it worrying about if somebody else is, you know.
Yeah.
If don't write for what somebody's going to like. Write what you like.
Right. The audience doesn't know what it wants. If the audience knew what it wanted, it wouldn't be an audience.
And I wouldn't have done Bone if I was waiting for somebody to say, that's a great idea.
Yeah.
In fact, I was told pretty specifically many times that it was a terrible idea.
Yeah. Look, Henry Ford had the greatest quote of all time about this stuff. He said, you know, the guy who invented the Model T, he said, if I'd asked people what they wanted, they would have said faster horses.
Yeah.
So they don't know what they want. Just write from the heart. Write about something that means something to you. Write about something where people make interesting decisions. Write about something where the story is about something that you believe other people could relate to on some level whatsoever. And that's not your guarantee of success, but that's the first big step.
Thank you.
Sure. I have a few more minutes. Yes, sir.
How do you know, I guess, talk about that. Ending of a book. Mm-hmm. Two questions. How do you know when a story is going to end? When you're done with the book, or when the whole book should end? Like, either when you should leave the book,
right,
and somebody carried somebody else, or I'm done with this book, this isn't yet.
When did you... I knew you know what the ending of your story was, obviously, Bone. You said you wrote that ahead of time, and you had some vague idea of how long you wanted to go. What time did you...
My flight's in an hour. It's probably not
good. Are you kidding me? Go.
3:55.
It's 1:55. Yeah, but still.
2 hours.
But still.
You're okay.
Well, I'm okay, but I should
don't listen to them.
I should probably go.
Midway.
And I can just grab the orange line.
You're okay, but you should leave.
Okay. Thanks, guys. See, time management.
So you'll never get an answer to your question.
My question is, my answer is, no, just know the ending first.
Yeah. Okay.
I mean, you'll look a lot smarter. Everybody will be amazed. Is that where you're going? I mean, people still ask me, did you know that's what you were doing?
And did it never change?
Yeah, no, there were things that did change.
But by and large, it never changed.
No.
And by and large, were there ever anything in the process, how long was the...
12 years.
In the 12 years, was there never a point in that 12 years where you were like, holy crap, I chose wrong?
Well,
about the ending?
Yeah, no, I knew the ending was going to be okay.
Okay.
But many times I got lost.
Yeah.
Like you were saying, where I made a wrong turn.
Yeah.
And once it's in print, though, it's
I know.
You got to really muscle that
no
thing
kidding.
Back on.
I know, I know. That's like getting...
Well, I beg your forgiveness, everyone. I guess I better run.
Say the panel was over, although we got about 5 more minutes and we'll take another couple of questions. If you want, I'm just saying, now that the czar has left, I'll field the other questions. Just say.
With the big New York book publishers all getting into the graphic novel business, how do you consider them indie publishers? How is that affecting what you do?
It doesn't really affect what we do on a day-to-day basis. I mean, I think it, philosophically, anything that helps put comics in front of the mass audience is great. I think that if it's helpful, it's in that it makes it more competitive, which is great. I mean, no longer does Harvey Peaker only have to choose from, you know, two or three indie comics houses to do his next project. He can now choose from, you know, HarperCollins or a few other major mainstream publishers with a little bit more dough, which is so that it forces us to raise our game. Don't tell anybody. Who else? Anybody else? Red vest. Yes, sir.
When do you stop?
When you
stop? Like with a particular project, when do you stop trying to get it into like a certain level? That you, if you're producing something, it's not selling. You don't have the audience.
Good question. What point? You're not. If I understand your question, it's not when do you stop trying to sell your thing. It's when it's once it's up and running and you feel like it's sort of running out of steam, or it's not, or the audience says it's running out of steam, or the sales are slipping and stuff.
When you're building your audience.
When you're building your audience, yeah.
The audience isn't building.
Right, and the audience isn't building. I don't know. I mean, I've been really lucky. And luck, as you can see, play as I'm a case study of, is a lot more important than talent. and I've been really lucky. I've not had that situation yet, but for instance, with the stuff I'm doing with Boom now, where I'm launching stuff that's basically, you know, it's non-existing character, pre-existing characters, it's stuff that's out of my head, it's stuff that's basically selling on my name and what I do, scarier, and therefore I may have an answer for you like a year or two from now if we realize that Incorruptible is no longer climbing or Irredeemable is, you know, plateaued out or slacking down or whatever. I don't know. So I don't want to go out on that question for the love of God. It's, yes, sir, gray shirt.
Do you have any interest at all in writing things that aren't going to be in a comic format?
Personally? Not really. Not because I'm not good at it. Frankly, I may not be the best writer in the world, but I know how to use comics. Like, I feel very confident in my ability to know what a comic book can do, and I feel like on a craftsman level, not on an art level, I think I'm a very good comic book writer. If I do say so myself, I don't mean that to be false modesty. I'm saying, or false arrogance. But the prose kicks my ass because I've not had much experience with that. And then you start getting into television and movies. Well, the beauty of comics is that I write it, my artist draws it, we publish it, and that's pretty much the way I want it to be. And in TV and movies, the money's better and the exposure's better, but you trade that off against the idea that suddenly, you know, it's written by committee and a million other people have something to say about it, and it goes through rewrite after rewrite because the producer's girlfriend's assistant thinks it should be different, and that's the kind of stuff that would make me snap. I always said that, I was asked frequently, like, did the Justice League cartoon people approach you about writing JLA cartoon stuff? And I always said, you know what? It's probably best that they don't. I like those guys, the ones that I know, but I know for a fact that the day I'm sitting across the table from somebody who says to me, well, I don't think Flash would do that, I'm going to be in jail the next day. I'm going to be in prison. So it's probably best to stay where I'm, you know, where I know what I'm doing. Green shirt said.
When are we getting more Potter's?
When are we going to get more Potter's Field? By the way, I'm very proud of that book. As I were talking about doing more now, Potter's Field, if you're not familiar with it, is the first thing I did through Boom Studios, actually. Thank you. It's a detective series. It's an idea I've been holding on to for a long time. There's actually a graveyard in New York City. It exists. It's Hart Island, where the city buries its anonymous dead. The people they find that they can't trace a name to, or the infants that are found with, mortality infants that there's no, identity for, or whatever. And I came up with the idea of a detective named John Doe, who we know nothing about. And his stated mission is he's going to make sure that all of those people die with a name. So he just goes from grave to grave and does the cold case and digs out all the information and finds out. And every episode ends with him carving that person's name on this anonymous gravestone and moving on to the next one. And he knows it's an impossible job to do it all, but that's kind of the tragedy of the character. I was doing that with an artist named Paul Azaceta, who is just brilliant. He's like the best of Alex Toth and David Mazzucchelli, and he's young. And he's way too young to be as good as he is. And he and I are talking about doing more with that later this year. It'd be nice doing like another one-shot with that or something. There's a hardcover collection on sale at the Boom Studios booth downstairs if you're interested, but I'm not going to hard sell you. But if you're so inclined, I think it's some strong work. And Paul's stuff is terrific looking.
You want to hard sell all
Right, he'll hard sell it for you. There you go. So, any one last question before we have to wrap up? Anybody? Anybody? Nobody wants to know Clark Kent's social security number. Thank God. All right. yes, sir.
I'm not sure exactly how involved you were or whatever. You were talking about how back in the 90s or late 80s, the Wizard World of Chicago or Comic Con or whatever it was over here, it was fantastic.
Yep.
And it's almost, in my opinion, when Wizard took it over.
Oh yeah. You want that on the record? You want that on tape? Absolutely. When Wizard took those shows over,
now,
it just,
I was going to say, and now, like, why? Was it them saying, DC, we want it this way, DC didn't want to do it that way, or?
I don't really know the inner machinations. All I know is they turned a great event into something that, by the end of it, not even Marvel or DC would send people out to. And, you know, it's the fact that we now have a really strong Chicago show with this one, and everybody I've spoken to, you know, publishers and fans alike, like, they can't wait to come back next year to this thing. It's not, maybe it's not as giant big as we maybe hoped it would be. I think that from my, you know, from what I'm seeing, and this is purely personal and purely anecdotal, I'm going to say it's probably about 80%, 75-80% of what I really kind of hoped it would be in terms of attendance. That's just me speaking personally. But I'll take that, because that means that next year we can get up to 90%, 100%, 110%. I mean, I think this thing will grow, and everybody really wants there to be a good Chicago show. And on that note, I think we're going to have to leave it and let it go, and thank God Jeff Smith checked his plane ticket.
He's in a cab right now.
All right, excellent. Thank you, sir. And coincidentally, you just happened to get an autograph and a sketch from him. So...
make the most of every opportunity.
Dude, I still have Dave Sim sketches from the night he told me about his divorce. So, all right. Thanks so much for coming, everybody.